this morning, we're going to kind of do a really quick overview of the perinatal care core set. As Kate mentioned, I'm the clinical lead on this measure set. So we'll just go ahead and let's see if I have the right, let's see if this is the icon that moves it. No, that's not it. How do I
advance? So there's a little, on the sort of top left of the slide, there's a little blue arrow. It kind of looks like a play button. There you go.
Yay! Okay, well, this is a disclaimer. As of today, these are current. You know how that is. It can change at any moment. So, all right, so we're going to talk a little bit about the project. I'll get into each of the individual five measures, over some frequently asked questions and some resources for you, and then give you an idea of where we're at as far as the timeline of the project. So just to give you a little background information, this all started back in November of 2007 when our Board of Commissioners recommended at that time to retire the Pregnancy and Related Conditions core measure set. And they further recommended that it be replaced with an expanded set of measures based on the scientific evidence that was out at that time. So to that end, we went to the National Quality Forum to the Perinatal Care Project and took a look at the 17 measures that had been endorsed in October of 2008. At the same time, we also went out and appointed our technical advisory panel, and that's comprised of 10 clinicians representing ACOG and the Academy, Academy of Pediatrics, Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, American Congress of Nurse Midwives, AWON, National Perinatal Information Center, National Quality Forum, and the CDC. So we have nurse physicians, those with measure development experience, and nurse midwives all sitting on this panel. We held our meeting then in February of 2009. At that time, our panel selected five measures to be further specified. So that was more or less my life for most of 2009, working on getting the specifications done in a uniform manner. Our first version of the manual then was posted in October of 2009, and we started data collection a little over a year ago, April 1st of 2010. And we have since posted two additional versions. So currently now, starting with April 1st discharges, people are working off the 2011A version. And those will be the specifications that I'll be going over this morning in my presentation. So just a little background here to help you understand. We have a program called ORECS, and that's our performance measurement program. As part of the accreditation requirements, hospitals are required to collect and report on a minimum of four core sets if they're an acute care hospital. Now, if you're a women's specialty hospital, this will be one of the sets that you'll be using to meet that requirement because of the populations that you serve. The other core measure sets are pneumonia, AMI, heart failure, surgical care improvement project, which you're probably reporting on if you're doing hysterectomies, but certainly you wouldn't be doing the other three. So this would be one of the sets that you would be reporting on. Now, if you're an acute care hospital with a labor and delivery unit, this would be an additional measure or one of your four sets if you didn't have the other populations. So that's just to kind of tell you how that works with the requirements. So here's the slide now that lists all five of the measures, the short names, and we'll go over each one of these now individually. First, though, I want to talk a little bit about the populations. This is one of these measure sets where we have two distinct populations. We have the mothers and we have the newborns. The first three measures represent the mothers. The last two represent the newborns. And of these five measures, we have three domains of care that are represented: assessment and screening, prematurity care, and then finally infant feeding. So the first measure, our elective delivery measure, comes to us from the Hospital Corporation of America, the Women's and Children's Clinical Services. They were the original measure developers. The domain that we're looking at here is assessment and screening. This is a maternal measure, and it's also a process measure. I want to first give a definition, though, of what an elective delivery is, and that would be the delivery of a newborn when the mother was not in active labor or presenting with spontaneous ruptured membranes prior to the medical induction and or cesarean section. This is a measure where we're looking for a lower rate as noted improvement. This slide displays what the national rates were for the first quarter of 2010 and the second quarter. And as you can see, we're running nationally somewhere around 19%, a little over 19%, just to give you a flavor of what's going on. Now, the reason that this is an important measure is because there has been a standard in place for some time from both ACOG and AAP that you should have 39 weeks completed before considering an elective delivery. we do know that even a few days difference can result in more morbidity for the newborn, and there are studies that show in many cases it can double the cesarean section rate if they're not ready. So looking now at the populations that are measured with this particular measure, in our denominator, that's our lower number here on the screen, we're looking at those mothers that are delivering newborns that have reached 37 weeks of gestation and are just under 39, so they're at 38 and 6/7 week gestation completed. Of those mothers, then, we would look to see how many ended up having an elective delivery. And once again, remember, we're looking to lower this number. Now, we also have populations that we look at within the denominator that aren't defined in the statement. There are no additional inclusions, but there are some exclusions. We do have a table that lists ICD-9 diagnosis codes for conditions that might possibly justify an elective delivery prior to 39 weeks. You'll find that in Appendix A of our online manual, and it's on Table 11.07. We also are excluding those mothers that are less than 8 years of age or equal to or greater than 65 years of age, anyone that's had a stay of greater than 120 days, and any mother that might be enrolled in a clinical trial related to pregnancy would be excluded from this measure. Now, we capture this information via data elements. Many of these are data elements that can be derived from administrative data, such as admission date, birth date, discharge date, your ICD-9 codes. Clinical trial can be set to default because I would imagine for the most part there aren't clinical trials being done on pregnant women, but we always have to make for that allowance. Gestational age is something that you do have to derive, though, however, from reviewing the medical record. And gestational age, we define that as the number of weeks that have elapsed between the first day of the last normal period, not the presumed time of conception, and the date of delivery, and that's irrespective of whether the gestation results in a live birth or a fetal death. Now, gestational age should be rounded off to the nearest completed week, not rounded up. So if you have an infant born on the fifth day of the 36th week, that would be 35 weeks and 6-7 days. The gestational age would be 35 weeks in this case. Numerator populations, now looking at inclusions there, we do have people and other procedure codes for the following, and that would be medical induction of labor on table 11.05 and cesarean section as defined on 11.06 as long as the mother wasn't in active labor or experiencing a spontaneous rupture of membranes. And there are no additional exclusions that we haven't already discussed. Looking now at the data elements, we do have a couple of new ones here, the active labor and then the spontaneous rupture of membranes that we would talk about. Now, active labor is defined as follows. If the patient presents without a previous cesarean section scar with regular uterine contractions and demonstrated cervical change, for example, dilation increases from 1 to 2 or 2 to 3 before you might eventually augment them, or prior to a cesarean section, you would say that, yes, they are in labor. If a patient presents with a previous cesarean section scar with regular uterine contractions and demonstrated cervical change again, or if they present being dilated at least 2 centimeters or more, in this case you would select yes that they were in active labor. SROM is confirmed by a positive Ferning test, a positive nitrosine test, positive pooling of gross fluid in the vagina, positive amniocere test or its equivalent, or a patient report of SROM prior to hospital arrival. Gestational age, we've put something in this last version of the manual here to help when we do have those cases where patients in, let's say they're admitted and it takes them a couple of days before they deliver. The way we had our suggested data sources ordered, you'd be looking at the history and physical and prenatals prior to the delivery record. And we've been told that in many cases, obviously, there's a couple of days difference, which might put them either in or out of this measure. So we do tell you or direct you to look at the record that was completed closest to the delivery, so in some cases that might be the delivery record. Also, if an ultrasound has been performed within the first 20 weeks of pregnancy and there's a discrepancy of 6 days or more, then you would take a look at the ultrasound to use that to determine final gestational age. So now we'll move into our second measure. This is the cesarean section measure, and this comes to us from the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative. The domain that we're looking at here, again, is assessment and screening. This is also a maternal measure, and this is an outcome measure. So we'll talk a little bit about how we're adjusting for that. And this is a rate where we're looking at a lower rate as noted improvement, similar to measure one. National rates, now these are not with any kind of a risk adjustment applied, so you're not seeing these displayed yet up on quality checks. So these are rough rates, and this may change once the model's been applied, but you can see it's running around 27% for the first two quarters of last year. This is an important measure because if you read any kind of news or go on the internet, there's always somewhere you can find an article about our rising cesarean section rates here in the United States. And when we look back at the evidence, we know that first birth mothers with a single baby in the normal position at term are the ones that are what we would call low risk and the ones where you can really put your performance improvement activities towards to help reduce the rate in this particular population. So looking now at our numerator and denominators, we are once again looking at those first birth moms, one baby in a vertex position at term, and of those then we would look further to see how many had a cesarean section. In the denominator included populations, we once again have the diagnosis ICD-9 code tables on table 11.08 that helps you determine that you have a singleton, and once again we're looking at they've reached at least the 37 weeks or more of gestation and it's their first birth. Under exclusions, we do have table 11.09 in Appendix A again. These would be contraindications to a vaginal delivery. They're primarily excluding patients that have codes for multiple gestations, breech deliveries, transverse lie, that sort of thing. And we're also excluding our very young and very old mothers, those that have a very long length of stay, and any of those that might be in a clinical trial related to pregnancy. Now the denominator data elements are very similar to measure one, except we've added a new one here, and that's your parity. And basically, you're looking at any number of deliveries that resulted in either live or stillborn infants that the patient experienced prior to the current hospitalization. Looking at numerator populations, once again, we'll go back to table 11.06. That's our cesarean section table. If they have an included code, procedure code there, they would be in the numerator, and there are no additional exclusions that we haven't already addressed. Numerator data elements are pretty straightforward. Those are going to be those ICD-9 procedure codes. Now, as I mentioned, this is an outcome measure, so we've applied a sort of a risk adjustment model. It's actually direct standardization, and we're doing it by age bands for maternal age. This next slide shows you how we've broken this out, and this is based on how it was originally designed. So you have your various age ranges, so this helps equalize if you have a lot of young mothers or old mothers at your particular facility, this model will be applied to that rate. And then we've also added in parity under the notes for abstraction. We were using the old school terminology with gravida, para, abortion, and so forth. And now we're being told that the GTPAL terminology is used quite a bit, where G equals gravida, T is term, P is preterm, A is abortion, L is living. So what you would do in this case, if you're using this terminology, is add all your previous term and preterm deliveries together prior to the hospitalization, and that will get you your parity number. Also, parity is not documented, but gravidity is documented as 1, then parity at that point would be considered 0. Okay, moving on to our third measure. This is our antenatal steroid measure. This comes to us from the Providence St. Vincent's Hospital and the Council of Women and Infants Specialty Hospitals. The domain represented here is prematurity care. This, again, is a maternal measure. It's a process measure. And this is our first measure in the group that we're looking for a higher rate as noted improvement. Looking at national rates from our first and second quarter, we're running around the 60 percentile, give or take, as far as documenting that a full course has been given for these mothers. This is an important measure because the NIH has had out this recommendation since 1994. They even revisited, I believe, in 1997 or 98 and made no further changes to that. And just based on studies, we do know that if they get the steroids, that it can reduce the risk of respiratory problems, mortality, and other morbidities for these premature newborns. Looking now at our numerator and denominator, we have added to the denominator that now we're looking for the live preterm newborns at 24 to 32 weeks gestation completed. That's something before we didn't have live in there, and fetal demise was inadvertently being included in the first go-round, and now that's been taken out. Of these mothers, then, we would be looking to see who received a full course of antenatal steroids prior to delivering the preterm newborn. Looking at the denominator populations, there are no additional inclusions. But going on to our exclusions, once again, the same familiar ones, the very young, the very old mothers, those with a long length of stay, the clinical trial, and then the reason for not giving a full course of steroids. And this might be fetal distress, imminent delivery, other reasons documented by your physician, APN, PA, or your certified nurse midwife. Also, we have ICD-9 diagnosis codes for fetal demise, and that's defined on table 11.09.1. Looking at our denominator data elements then, once again, these are mostly administrative here, admission date, birth date, clinical trial, discharge date, then our diagnosis codes, and then the gestational age, and then that reason for not administering the antenatal steroid being documented. Going into our numerator, we'd be looking for a full course of antenatal steroids, and we define that as two doses of 12 milligrams of betamethasone IM 24 hours apart, or four doses of 6 milligrams of dexamethasone IM every 12 hours. No additional exclusions here. And then the numerator, of course, would be looking at that full course. And we have added now in our notes for abstraction that minimally the names and dose and time should be in the record. And we're giving you a window now for repeat dose on betamethasone, 4 hours either prior to or after that 24-hour repeat period, and for dexamethasone, 2 hours prior or after that 12-hour repeat period would still be considered acceptable. Moving now into our fourth measure, healthcare-associated bloodstream infections in newborns. This comes from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. The domain represented here is prematurity care. This is our first newborn measure in the set, and it is an outcome measure, so we'll talk about how that is risk-adjusted. And a healthcare-associated infection would be a localized or systemic condition that results from an adverse reaction to the presence of an infectious agent or its toxin, and there must be no evidence the infection was present or incubating at the time of admission to the care setting. So basically, we're saying that if the baby was born with an infection, they're out of the measure, and we'll show you that here in a second. This is one where we're looking for a lower rate again for improvement, and we do not have any rates to display for this on this particular measure because we had to make some revisions to it during the first release of the manual, so we didn't want to put those out because we weren't 100% sure that there'd be any change as a result of these revisions, so we'll be seeing those a little bit later this year. This is an important measure because the rates can range anywhere from up to a 6% to up to a third of newborns being impacted with this, and we know that if there is an infection, it increases the probability of a mortality if they're very fragile, a longer length of stay, and hospital costs, and there are a number of preventive measures that can be put in place to reduce infections. Looking now at our numerator and denominator, in our denominator we're looking at live-born newborns. And then in our numerator, we're looking at those newborns that have septicemia or bacteremia. Now we get into our denominator, and we have two distinct populations. Our first is looking at those very low birth weights of 500 to 1499 grams. If you've coded them on tables, this whole measure can be done with administrative data. The second population is looking at those that have reached at least 1,500 grams, but they would have had to have experienced one or more of the following, and that would be they would have expired, they would have had a major surgery as defined on the principal or other procedure codes on table 11.18, they would have had to have been mechanically ventilated as defined with procedure codes on table 11.19, or they would have been transferred in from another acute care hospital within 2 days of birth. Looking now at our exclusions, this first exclusion would be for those babies transferred in with a principal diagnosis code for sepsis. That meant they were born with it and transferred into you. They would be excluded. And the second one would be for those babies born at your hospital where they have the ICD-9 code for the live-born newborn as defined on table 11.10.3 and a newborn septicemia or bacteremia other diagnosis code as defined on table 11.10. Also, those babies that are under 500 grams are excluded, and anyone that has a length of stay less than days or greater than 120, or if the baby's enrolled in the clinical trial as a result of being a neonate, they would be out of the measure. Now, at our denominator data elements, we're basically looking at a lot of administrative data derived from your records there. Admission type is something new here that you haven't seen before. Birth weight, if it's coded, once again, would be administrative. Discharge status, point of origin, and all your ICD-9 codes for diagnosis and procedure codes. Going into our numerator now, there are two ways that they would be included. First, if they have sepsis, septicemia codes on table 11.10.1, or if they have one code from table 11.10 and 11.11, they would be then in the population. And once again, we're just looking at other diagnosis codes to get them in. And then our risk adjustment, as I mentioned, because this is an outcome measure, we're looking at three birth weight categories that you see on the screen, also a number of congenital anomalies that are GI, cardiovascular, and other specified ones through ICD-9 codes. An outborn birth and a death or a transfer out would be risk adjusted. So now let's move into our final measure, the exclusive breast milk feeding measure. This comes to us from the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative, and this is also a process measure, and it's a newborn measure, and we're looking at infant feeding for the domain, and a higher rate would be noted for improvement with this measure. And as I mentioned, we are not displaying the rates on this at this point in time, but suffice to say we're nowhere near where we would like to be. The rationale for this is because this has been a really long-term goal for the World Health Organization, the Department of Health and Human Services, AAP and ACOG, and the studies are overwhelming in the numerous benefits for both the newborn and the mother. Looking now at our numerator and denominator, we're looking at those single-term newborns discharged from the hospital in the denominator, and of those, we'd be looking at newborns that were fed breast milk only since birth. Going into our denominator populations, for our included population, we're looking that they have an ICD-9 diagnosis code on table 11.20.1 for a single newborn, and then we would be excluding those that had been admitted to the NICU at any time during the hospitalization, any newborn that was diagnosed with galactosemia as defined with the codes on table 11.21, any that would have received parenteral nutrition as defined with procedure codes on table 11.22, those that might have expired, had length of stay greater than 120 days, in a clinical trial as a result of being a newborn, or if there's a documented reason for not excessively feeding breast milk. And the only acceptable maternal medical conditions for which breast milk feeding should be avoided are one or more of the following medical conditions, which are HIV infection, human T lymphotrophic virus type 1 or 2, substance abuse or alcohol abuse, active untreated TB, if the mother's taking certain medications such as prescribed cancer chemotherapy, radioactive isotopes, antimetabolites, antiretroviral medications, or other medications where the risk of morbidity, if she stops them, outweighs the benefits of breast milk feeding. If the mother's undergoing radiation therapy, has active untreated varicella, or has active herpes simplex virus with breast lesions, also these would be reasons to not breastfeed. Looking at our denominator data elements, we do have the one here for admitting to the NICU. That would be a new one here. And basically, we are defining that as when they have a complex illness and they're basically requiring life-sustaining procedures and equipment and personnel organized in a unit that would be considered a NICU. We don't define it by a level of care because it does vary from region to region in the country, so we don't say a level 3 is a NICU versus a level 2 because it could be defined differently. So we're really looking at the type of care that they're being provided. And then going into further data elements here, we're looking at diagnosis and procedure codes, point of origin, and once again that documentation of the reason for not exclusively feeding breast milk. In the numerator populations, there are no additional inclusions or exclusions. And then the only data element we have here is exclusive breast milk feeding, which we're defining as a newborn receiving only breast milk, no other liquids or solids except for drops or syrups consisting of vitamins, minerals, or medicines. If the newborn receives any other liquids, including water, during the entire hospitalization, then you would select allowable value no. An exclusive breast milk feeding includes the newborn receiving breast milk via the bottle or any other means besides the breast. So we're just looking at the medium that they're receiving, not the method. Looking then in our notes for abstraction, we have added that if there's donor milk given, that's allowable value would be yes. If there's fortifier, that's acceptable. If there is conflicting documentation, you would defer to no. If there's both supplementation and exclusive breast milk feeding listed, you would default to no. And once again, we've added another note in here for the lactation consultant to document why they couldn't be fed breast milk. Now, quickly going into some of the FAQs, because I know we're coming up on the top of the hour here. For PCO1 for elective delivery, we do get questions, why aren't all of the ACOG justifications not considered? And really, what we're looking at with this particular measure is that we can't get everybody in here because of the amount of burden that it would require for you to get some of this information out of the medical record if there's not an ICD-9 code. So we're really just looking to help you establish that baseline. And once again, weighing out the burden of data collection. So we do try to make sure that we've gotten what we feel are the most appropriate ones in there. We've worked with the original measure developer on this and from other experts from our panel. And so we have what we consider the majority, but not all of them. So as a result, with this particular measure, you'll never be at 0% because there's always going to be some cases that can't be pulled out unless you're doing manual chart abstraction on each record. For example, would be a classical prior classical Caesarean section where there is no ICD-9 code for that. You'd have to review every single record for evidence of that in order to exclude those cases. So that's our rationale for not having every single exclusion in there. Moving into our Caesarean section measure, we do get questions here about why there's some of these other conditions are not considered as contraindications, such as if the mother has a cardiac problem or fetal distress. And that reason would be because this measure is designed to take a look at how labor has been managed and not exclude them. We know there's reasons that you're going to be doing a Caesarean section because of these, but the whole theory behind this measure is that looking at your medical practice might help to see if there would have been a way of preventing them going to a Caesarean section. Going into our exclusive breast milk feeding, this is by far probably the one we get the most questions on. Why was this selected? And the reason would be because we know rates are low. We have 30%. Well, I've heard in some places it's as low as 10%. And as I mentioned before, this is a long-term goal. Healthy People 2010 also have this in their goal. And the studies are really out there that really support this as a measure. Why aren't more newborn medical conditions excluded? This is a good question. It's because they vary according to how each hospital views these. For hypoglycemia, for example, your threshold might be different from hospital A versus hospital B before you would actually supplement and how you define hypoglycemia or other complications. As a result, we know that if we looked at maternal blood sugar control, if maybe that was better controlled, that there may be a lower rate of newborn hypoglycemia. So we really want everybody to kind of look at these complications to see if there's something that could have been done differently. And we don't expect that any one hospital should have any more hypoglycemia versus another. So once again, this is a measure where 100% is not going to be possible, but we certainly want you to be able to take a look and see where you're at. Now, this is another one that we get a lot of questions about the mother's choice not being considered an exclusion. And that would be pretty easy just to make that an exclusion. Everybody could check that off, and then we really wouldn't be going anywhere with it. We do recognize that mothers have a right to choose, and it has to be respected. We also know there is a number of educational programs out there based on scientific evidence that you can educate your staff, who in turn can work with your mothers, to help increase the number of mothers that are successful in breastfeeding, making sure that they're culturally sensitive, and that you really are integrating all of this into your education, that this can be something that you can be working on. Now, as far as resources, the March of Dimes has put out the Toward Improving Outcome of Pregnancy 3 available on the website at this link, and it's free to download, and it really goes from A to Z, looking at evidence-based practice with clinical guidelines throughout the course of the woman's life. And each chapter looks at specific strategies and interventions that incorporate robust process and systems changes and include the power of statewide quality improvement collaboratives just like yours that are improving perinatal outcomes. And it really has a lot of action items that stakeholders across the continuum of perinatal care can recognize as opportunities to improve pregnancy outcomes. So I highly recommend this. I've actually read it, and it's very well done. There is also a resource for elective delivery, a toolkit that's been developed by the March of Dimes and the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative, available at either of their websites. It's free to download, along with slides that you can use to display for your staff. And also, there are resources available for breast milk feeding promotion. The CDC has an excellent guide, and the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine has a number of evidence-based protocols that will help you, and the United States Breastfeeding Committee has a toolkit they put out to help you with PCO5. It's specifically for that measure. Now, as far as where we're at in our project, you can see that we've come a long ways, but we still have a couple of activities left. Towards this fall of this year, we'll be doing reliability site visits where Joint Commission staff pay a visit to a random number of hospitals, doing a sampling of records that have been previously submitted to see if we get the same answers that you get. This helps us understand how well we've written our measures and if we have to do further examples and further refine our definitions so that everybody gets the same answers. And after that, then we'll be working on our specifications as a result of our testing. So there'll be about 12 sites we'll be visiting from October through January of next year. And our manual is, as I mentioned, online. This is the link where you can find it. You can also post questions there. But the manual is very nice. It's interactive. There's links that go between the data elements, the measure information forms, and various sections of the manual. It's very easy to navigate, very user-friendly. And at this point, I'm going to open it up for questions, but I don't know if we have people left or if there's time for that. But that it pretty much concludes my presentation this morning.